AM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Welcome, this is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. That's 90.7 on your FM dial. I am talking with Smith Henderson today about his debut novel titled 4th of July Creek. Welcome.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You have received some awards lately, one of which was a pushcart prize. The other was a pen award for Best Emerging Writer. That's gotten you some attention. People have been looking forward to this book, and it's excellent. It's got nothing but rave reviews that I've read, and which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, tell me about it. Go ahead. Yeah, no, I was just agreeing. Yeah, it's been great. It's been really exciting to see that it's finding readers.
It definitely deserves it.
Oh, thank you.
The book revolves around primarily a caseworker in the Department of Family Services in Montana named Pete Snow. Could you tell us about Pete?
Yeah, gladly. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you.
Pete's a social worker in northwestern Montana. The year is 1979 when the book begins, and he has a couple things working against him, just personally in his job, make his job difficult. One is he's from the Mountain West, so there's a lot of cowboy culture. There's a lot of tough guy types that aren't going to necessarily even know what he does for a living, let alone appreciate it. So he's a bit of an outcast in what he does, but he's also really good at what he does, and he's also very Montanan, which means, unfortunately, he drinks a lot as well. So he has his own demons, I guess. Yeah. So and at the beginning of the book, he has actually moved away from his hometown to work even more remotely. So that's kind of another thing that's happening with him, is that he's quite isolated and has a large range of area to cover, and the people that he serves are stridently independent and often don't believe in the post office, much less in child protective services.
Right, a government worker.
Yeah, he's a godless bureaucrat. But I mean, the reality in the book is portrayed hopefully with a little bit more color and complication. The people he serves do need his help. There's actually, I'll go ahead and read from a little section at the beginning of the book when we meet one of his first cases. He's been called in to a school. There's been an incident, and this is one of the rare instances where he's actually called into the school. Some of the older children said they'd seen the boy on the playground, but no one talked to him as he edged his way along the fence and over to watch the kids on and around the jungle gym. He sat on one of the half dump truck tires in the wood chips, bonging his enormous boots against the rubber. The kids who noticed the boy didn't speak to him. Some 30 minutes later, Principal Pemberton found him on the second floor outside Miss Kelly's art class. The nurse was with the child now. Pete and Pemberton regarded them from behind the glass of the door. He turned to run, so I grabbed his arm and he bit me. Pete looked at Pemberton. He showed Pete his hand. Didn't break the skin, though. Pete looked through the window at the kid. He wore brown camouflage pants that were rolled at the cuffs to fit him, and a darker brown sweater that hung on him wholly as netting. Leaves and pine needles stuck to the wool in his knit cap. His eyes scanned the room, lighting on Pete behind the glass only long enough to look away and study the room. "I got him wrapped up, but just barely," Pemberton said. "The kid's strong for his size." He rapped on the glass and the nurse came out. "He's got bloody gums," she said to Pemberton. "I think he has scurvy." "And he reeks," the nurse said. The boy stood with his hands on his hips. He ran a sleeve under his nose. His movements were swiftly mannish, as though he were another species and full grown for it, a pygmy or some other reduced people. Did you get a name off of him? No, he wouldn't tell me. How's he been? Pete asked the nurse. You know, sweet as a little bell. And no one has any idea where he's from. None of the other kids know him. Pemberton shook his head. The boy sat back on the exam table and unlaced his enormous boots, and after he pulled them from his feet, plucked out the rags balled into each to fill the space after his toes ended. He sniffed the second of these rags like it held some information, shook it out as he had the first one, and laid it to the side of him. He tugged off cheesecloth socks. His bare feet were sickening. A thin flap of sole skin hung from his foot, and he pulled it off like a piece of wet sack paper. He smelled this, too, held it up to the light, and tossed it onto the floor where it set like a gray cold cut. The rest of his foot like a stem, a tuber, or root. My word, the nurse said. The boy looked up at their blanched faces and resumed the crude debridement of his feet. Pete opened a notepad and wrote down the name of a pediatrician, tore off the paper, and handed it to Pemberton. This guy's retired and a little deaf. Let it ring and he'll eventually answer. Ask if he can come down. Pete opened the door and went in. The boy glanced up but kept picking at his feet. Pete took a chair across from him. Hi, I'm Pete. He leaned down and saw the gray sags under the child's eyes on an otherwise clean, pale face. There was a taupe grime of dirt and ash all over his clothes. He smelled like a burnt match and salted fatback. His chopped hair shot out in brown shocks. So what's your name? Benjamin. You mind if I ask how old you are? Go on ahead. Pete grinned. How old are you? 11. Really? You don't look more than 8 or 9 to me. The boy licked his fingers and seemed to be pressing loose skin in place. Where are you from? The kid tossed his head. In town somewhere? The kid shook his head no. Well, where's your mama and daddy? The kid began to roll down his long socks. Light could be seen through them. Your feet hurt? Not bad. You must have walked a long way for them to get like that. The boy pulled on the socks and then began to stuff the rags back into his boots. A vinegar odor wafted across to Pete. Listen, I'm from DFS. I can take you home. The kid pulled one of the great black boots onto his foot and began to lace it. Sorry, Department of Family Services, that's what the letters mean. I'd like to see if you and your family need anything. Help with the groceries, or maybe some medicine or something. Anything. The kid tugged on the other boot and laced it. What do you think? Pete asked. The boy stood on his newly booted feet and rocked in place on them. I got a he said.
That was an excellent introduction to Ben Pearl. What about his father now?
So what happens after this scene is that he takes the kid out for lunch. He takes him out to get some clothes. He's setting him up to, you know, take him out to his parents' house. They go out where the kid says he thinks they live, but he's not sure because he just hikes out of the woods. He doesn't really know the way by the roads. It's a little strange. As they get out there, it's starting to get on dark. And when they return the boy to his family, this man appears. And his name is Jeremiah Pearl, and he shoots a rifle in the air and shines a really bright jacklight in Pete's face and even knocks him down at one point. And he orders the kid to take off the clothes, and Pete says, "Hey, whoa, you know, I wouldn't have brought him back if I thought you were gonna, you know, take him out in the woods naked. It's cold out." And Jeremiah Pearl says, "You know, I'd kill him before I'd let you have him." And so Pete gets this immediate sense that this is not like his average client. This guy's, although the woods are filled with certain cranks who are on the run or different people, he hasn't quite had a case where there's someone who seems to be so far so anti any assistance, and so, you know, threatened by Pete, you know.
Feral.
Yeah, yeah. And so so Pete doesn't really have much of a obvious way to help them, but as the story progresses, it becomes more and more apparent to him that that is an urgency, that the Pearls are in danger because of their father, who is leaving coins with strange holes and marks in them around town, and is
like swastikas.
Yeah, yeah. So, he's punching strange shapes and swastikas and altering money, and he's sending threatening letters to government officials and starting to attract the attention of, you know, it's pretty obvious where he's headed as the book progresses.
Well, was Pete told that the rest of his family was up in the woods? I mean.
Yeah, so the boy tells him that they're living out in the woods somewhere. So Pete eventually comes across the boy a couple more times and starts to earn their trust, and, you know, at some point gets into their world, gets to hang out with them, and he discovers that it's just the man and the boy, and the rest of the family is somewhere else, and they're living from camp to camp, and Jeremiah Pearl's the kind of guy, if he sees some sort of jet contrails in the air, he thinks it's, you know, someone spying on him. He's super paranoid. But eventually Pete kind of overcomes that because Pearl starts to see that perhaps Pete is instrumental in some way in whatever his final destiny is going to be.
And is Ben at that point starting to trust him?
Yeah, Ben's, you know, it's not played for heavy drama, but there is a clear thread throughout the book, which is having to do with that boy's soul. Is he going to, he's obviously been through a lot living with his father. He knows that his father isn't perfect, but he loves him. And then there's this strange man who's willing to help, and but his beliefs and his family's beliefs sort of prevent him from fully crossing over to totally trusting Pete.
Yeah, the way you depict that tension throughout the book, whenever you're talking about them, is very effective. I really liked it.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do get an opportunity to have some adventures, I guess you'd call them. There is a little bit, this is a pretty grim book. There's a lot of dark stuff in it, but some of the lighter passages surprisingly start to happen in this strange environment that Pete finds himself in. There's a section I'd love to read about a time they're out hunting. Pete has begun to stay with them while they're poaching. They're hunting out of season, but it's kind of how they're living off the land in this place in the northwestern Montana. This picks up with them doing that. Of course, Benjamin called in no elk or other animals, though several large creatures of opportunity, vultures, hawks, gripped the power lines running from a metal tower that bisected the meadow. When Jeremiah gave up on the elk, he let Ben run over to gawk at the tower. The boy was only gone a few minutes when he shrieked, and Pearl and Pete looked at one another and sprinted toward him, both hollering that they were coming. The scene at which they arrived was grim. The boy stood at the edge of an area no bigger than a patio, where the grass had been walked flat, and on which lay several dead animals and a writhing smoke of flies. There lay a turkey with a parcel of naked black skin near what looked to be the desiccated corpse of a raccoon. Not far away, a deer with its throat ripped open lay next to a coyote, the coyote on its side like an exhausted sleeping dog, next to it a fox. Strangest of all, the black bear. Flat on its back, legs and arms spread wide as though it were playing dead or at some kind of profane joke. Huge blue bottle flies worked over everything, and the air hummed with them. The air was charged, as by a television picture tube, with the sound all the way down. Pearl squatted near the turkey and plucked a loose feather from the bird. The feather's vein burned away. "Don't touch anything," Pete said. He put his palms in the air in front of him. "You feel that?" Pearl stood, gripped Ben. A power line snaked down from the tower into the grass, and Pete pointed to it. "That's a line down. Oh, let's step back, Benjamin," Pearl said. They paced backward the way they came, but this time ginger as sappers, and stopped and looked back and talked animatedly about the electrocuted animals, and then retreated to the far side of the meadow and up the hill to a naked outcropping where they could watch what might happen next. The turkey vultures turned in slow circles, black and crew waiting for them to leave. The men and the boy were as giddy as princes. I mean, it just seems cruel to watch, Pete said. He pulled the binoculars from his eyes and handed them to Benjamin. You ever seen such a thing? This is nuts. Here they go, Benjamin whispered, as the first of the vultures landed and waddled awkwardly toward the carcasses, drawn by their own natural valence toward death. Several more landed in proximity, and immediately the birds began to jostle for position, all six or seven of them hopping and striving, at last perching on the bear, the coyote, their wings folding in and fanning out like black umbrellas triggered to open according to their enthusiasms. Pearl took the binoculars from his son. Maybe they shut off the power. Nah, you could feel. There came the flash, and a millisecond later the air clapped with electrocution as the two of the vultures stiffened in attitudes black and fixed as logos before they fell over, smoking. The remaining birds heaved into the air. The Pearls and Pete gasped at one another like 12-year-old boys, then they rollicked with laughter. They waited a half hour for the vultures to land again, and though the birds circled in the air and perched and longed from the tower, they seemed to have learned their lesson. What a thing to see, Pete, Pearl, and the boy were saying as they headed back to camp, and when the evening air cracked again, they laughed again too and wondered aloud, were vultures that stupid, or what manner of opportunist had been killed this time? So as the story progresses, the events begin to spiral out of control, and the government becomes involved in searching for Pearl, and the reaction in the local town of 10 Mile, where the book is set, is one of first of agitation and resentment, and then eventually violence, the kind of domestic violence that doesn't happen very often here, but often enough. So I read a little bit about something like that happening in 10 Mile. One morning, a madman tosses a stick of dynamite into the post office. The windows blow out and a postman is killed, and another man stumbles outside, burned and bleeding and naked, save the tops of his overalls that hang on him like a denim bib. He staggers across the street, holding his insides inside. He makes the courthouse lawn just in time for Pete to exit his office and see what's the matter. Then he pitches over, smoking, dying from his injuries on a thin crust of rime and old snow. People appear from all over, go to the man. A woman runs to her car and comes back with a quilt, and a doctor arrives, addresses the man's injuries for a time, and then covers his head with the blanket. The shock is palpable. Weeping. The brick post office is still somewhat afire, but only somewhat, and a volunteer fireman puts out most of it with the Sunrise Cafe's kitchen fire extinguisher. A squad car races up the street, presumably hard after the terrorist. The mayor and the judge consult with the chief of police, not 20 feet from the dead men. Clerks and secretaries hold closed their coats, waiting to be told what to do. Pete crosses the street to the Sunrise. Old boys stand outside smoking, darkly delighted that something so outrageous has occurred. Even they are doing their part, comparing it to the bank robbery of 1905, contextualizing this event in the history of the place, making the first stabs at rendering it for all time. Pete sits in a booth by the window. His finger idles around the tabletop, a nickel with a swastika in it. And the waitress at last comes over with water, a place setting, and a menu. She observes the paramedics loading the dead man's body into an ambulance. I heard he's dead. I believe that's right. I could just spit. Well, I bet you could do better than that, Pete said. She has had a hard life. You can tell from the way her face has aged, the frowns etched there. But Pete's remark elicits an endangered smile. He's recognized her, something deeply true about her, and it is a pleasant thing to be seen and for her toughness to be acknowledged. Yeah, I could do better than that. What do you have, hon?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
That's cool.
You are listening to an interview with Portland-based writer Smith Henderson, author of 4th of July Creek. The interviewer is Jay Thiemeyer. This is Between the Covers on KBOO Portland.
Let me see. There are so many elements. You have these various threads that are going through the entire book, and we're just sort of shifting. They aren't as abrupt as like flashbacks, but to me, it's really smooth. A person doesn't get jogged out of the general stream of the book.
Yeah.
One thread is what's going on with Pete and his wife, now separated, and most of all with his daughter.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that, please?
Yeah. He's found out at the beginning of the book, you know, this wife had cheated on him, and he's been so without resources personally to care for himself. He's been pretty much a bad husband and father preceding this. And he does what those bad kinds of parents do, which is a lot like not too dissimilar from all of his clients. He runs off and takes some solace in the fact that he's doing work. And his wife and daughter wind up leaving town. So I'll read a little bit from that section. We can talk a little bit about these afterward. What was it like on the way to Texas? It was Wyoming, which means to drive forever through ugly scrubscape, the color of dirty pennies. It was just Wyoming along. They were Wyoming forever. You could Wyome all day and not make any progress. To Wyome was to go from nowhere to nowhere, through nowhere, to see nothing, to do nothing but sit. You turn on the radio and Wyome through the dial slowly, carefully, in search of a sliver of civilization, only to find a man talking about the price of stock animals and feed. Did her mom Wyome too? Mom Wyomed all through Colorado. She smoked, she drank coffee and tab and then beer, Wyoming her fingers on the wheel sometimes, and stopping to Wyome to someone on the payphone, maybe daddy, but probably that friend in Texas, the truck driver. Is he your boyfriend? It's an old friend, Rachel Leslie. Old friend from when? From when I worked at the trucking company. He's a trucker. So that's why we're going all the way to Texas. He said we could stay with him. Yes. What's his name? Jimmy. How do you know him? I told you from when I was a receptionist. Did you do it with him too? What is that supposed to mean? Him to what? Come on. I know why daddy left. Did her mother hit her or pull over or give her some kind of talking to? Worse. What did she do? She cried. Drops big and quiet racing down her face. Did it unnerve Rachel? Yes. Why? Because her mother's heart was Wyoming. It was Wyoming hard. And she was days and years and maybe forever from a good man.
Nice.
Thank you. I wrote a lot of those sections in Q&A style, all those sections in Q&A style. And that was actually kind of an accident, or started as a deficit of some sort. I was working, like you said, there were a lot of plot threads in the book, and you can't really write all of them at once. Like you have to decide, okay, I'm going to work on this through line and I'll follow up this thread. When I was writing her stuff, one way I'd generate new material for anything I was writing is I'd write Q&As. So I would just say, you know, where's Pete from? Choteau, Montana. What's Choteau, Montana? It's like a cow town, and just kind of keep going and generating material that way. And when I would go in and work on her stuff, I just found that I liked the Q&A, and it finally dawned on me that it was doing a couple of things. It was signaling that these were some kind of special sections, you know, which to me, I wanted to pay attention to them in a different way. It was almost like a Greek chorus where they comment on the action. It's not quite part of the main narrative, but you're getting information. And the other thing it was doing was, it, you know, his daughter winds up taken off and seeking her own freedom. And she's only, you know, she's only 13, 14. And this really tears at Pete. He realizes now that he's too late, that he's failed to take care of his daughter. He knows the kinds of things that could happen to her. And so the Q&A for me functioned as a reader, of the book. I felt like when I read it, I was hearing his anxieties, even though it's not really directly from his point of view. You're feeling it as a reader. Where is she? Where is she? Where is she? Is she okay? Is she okay? Is she okay? Yeah.
And the way you did that, it's just, as I say, it was just very fluid, and it just kept up this sort of momentum that was going. I like that, the Greek chorus.
Yeah,
effect.
Yeah, thanks.
Where does Rachel doesn't find exactly paradise when she runs away? For one thing, she finds Seattle.
She finds Seattle.
Right.
Seattle in the 1980.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit, because it struck me as being a very resourceful young woman at 13 or 14 to be able to do that. And she was just sort of learning by doing. I mean, and she had the guts or the confusion to keep doing that, keep pressing.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I think that she's one of the most heroic characters in the book in a lot of ways, even though she makes a lot of, like every character in the book, makes a lot of terrible decisions. Mm-hmm. She is trying to figure out how to negotiate her way through the world herself and be free. And that's really, you know, a through line of the entire novel. It's a question that the novel is constantly asking is what's the limit, you know, on our freedom? What sort of things are we going to allow each other to do to ourselves and to each other before our similar impulse to create a community kicks in and we say, okay, that's enough, you know? And so, she falls in with some street kids in Seattle. And, you know, if you grew up where I did and you live in the Intermountain Northwest and it's kind of all small towns and there's not this, it's a kind of a shock to see like a bunch of kids just kind of running wild on the streets. And you think, well, that's surely they there's some place for them. They should be arrested or they should be taken into a facility or they should be getting just a place to stay or foster care or whatever. And actually that's not the case. Our society isn't there for them. And so I really wanted to depict that and depict her navigating through the very system that Pete works in an urban environment.
What I was struck with is, for example, you have Jeremiah Pearl being anti-government, anti-establishment, anti-societal constrictions. You have Rachel basically escaping her kind of strictures. And I'm interested, I like the comparison between, or the contrast in some instances, between Rachel and Cecil and Ben. Because, for example, a person looking casually or objectively at the scene in Seattle that Rachel was coming into, just that disorder, these people ought to be locked up or put into treatment or something. Then you have Cecil, and you have Rachel's father explaining to him what the treatment that he has to look forward to if he keeps blowing off these foster parents.
Pete has perspective on the failings of the system and knows what's going on. And there's a scene where he is taking this young man, Cecil, who at the very opening chapter of the book, he's called on to deal with Cecil and his mother and Cecil's sister. And the mother and brother have been fighting a whole bunch. And now he's trying to get him placed into his uncle's house. And he's just sort of horse traded them into taking him by like basically offering to like empty his wallet and get them the money, the monthly check that they're going to get, expedite that from the state government and anything he can to just get this kid into a safe environment, because he doesn't want to put him in juvie or a state mental hospital. He's trying to avoid that because that's actually going to break him. But the kid's hiding out in an outbuilding while he's talking to the uncle, and he says, I'm going to see what he's up to. And they run out there and get him. So he jogged across the yard, past the lunging silent dog. He felt lightheaded from the cigarette he'd just had, and when he got to the doorway of the huge outbuilding, he was panting. A rusted combine filled the main area. The snowmobile was off to the side. Cecil sat on a big round of pine. His hand fell gently from his face. He held a filthy red rag in his hand, and a bright red plastic gas can sat hard by. The boy's huge, dumb grin, eyelids half closed like a broken window shade. Pete stepped into the outbuilding, and the aluminum walls all around ticked in the wind like a cooling engine. He spat at a copper pipe, and it toned back at him for a long moment. The boy's eyes lolled. "You would love it at a treatment facility," Pete said. Cecil licked his lips as he turned toward this voice from the ether. "You know, they knock you out for days in a place like that. Just have to kick or hit or bite somebody. Whip out your d-. I know it. I seen it. And when you come to all groggy and d-ed up, they just wait and see if you do it again. And you will. They all do." Pete peeked out the doorway to see that Elliot still smoked on the porch of the house. From inside his pocket, Pete removed his tiny flask, finished and replaced it, and approached the boy. "You know the worst part about treatment facilities, Cecil? The freedom. It's what they call a paradox, Cecil. No longer being afraid of ending up there is what makes you free to do anything. And all the anythings you can learn. How to fight with a toothbrush or a spoon. All the drugs there are to take. How to molest other kids. You won't believe the appetites you got once you're inside." The kid snorted or choked a little or coughed. From the stump, Pete lifted Cecil, who swayed and giggled. His actual breath stank of gasoline.
Yeah, nice. And should point out that the uncle was not Pete's uncle, but the kid's uncle.
The kid's uncle, yeah.
Who's as dysfunctional as the rest of the family.
Yeah, I mean, there's this sense that everybody there is strapped. In one way or another, either emotionally or financially, probably both. And that's definitely the case with everybody in Cecil's extended family, which is why he has trouble finding placements for him. So that's always the, you know, I think always the challenge with this stuff is finding a safe place for people to be in when we really don't have very many that are truly. And you have a kid, you're sort of responsible for that kid's safety. There's not a backup plan, you know.
Right. And the uncle said that they were so strapped he was going to re-up with the National Guard.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Resonates with what's happened since then.
Yeah.
The National Guard wasn't going to stay local.
You are listening to an interview with Portland-based writer Smith Henderson, author of 4th of July Creek. The interviewer is Jay Thiemeyer. This is Between the Covers on KBOO Portland.
This was around 1980. It was around the time of Reagan's election. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of playing in the background of all this and what was to come. And and Montana, as a context for that, is just so diverse in the way it... tell us about the 1980.
Yeah. It's interesting you pick up on a couple of things. I mean, first of all, the first thing that jumps in my head when you said so diverse, a lot of people don't think of Montana that way, but it is politically and socially pretty, it's a unique place. I mean, it's known for, you know, its natural beauty, and it's known for its lunatics, you know. This is sort of the things that it's, I don't know if this is a symptom of that or not, but I mean, this is a state that voted for George Bush, a Democratic governor, medicinal marijuana, and against gay marriage all in the same election.
Right.
So it's pretty all over the map, you would think. But there's the thing I realized when I was away from the state was just how much the state embodied a lot of American schisms, and that was an interesting setting in and of itself. And I had to read some Northwestern literature to appreciate that, to kind of understand that where I was from was interesting. And sometimes it was just Pacific Northwest literature, just realizing like how damn good Ken Kesey is, you know, or was, and Sherman Alexie, you know, and these people that Alice Munro. I mean, take the probably the blandest location on Earth, you know, and she finds such sadness and secrets, you know, and things to write about. And none of these writers, by the way, are influences on my own writing. I was definitely much more influenced by Southern literature, but there was a sense that the place I was from had just as much trauma and trouble in it
as Yagapatapa County.
That
Faulkner's country.
Yep. Yeah. And then when the other thing I was going to, you know, towards the point about 1980, I don't know, there was a desire to a need almost to isolate Pete, and so putting him in a time when he couldn't have like a cell phone, although I don't know if there's cell phone reception up in the Yak right now anyway, but putting him in a place where he didn't have that kind of access, and putting him in a time where the social services that he works in didn't really come to understand secondary trauma in the way we have, and so that he wouldn't have the resources professionally to take care of him. So not only is he physically, but he's professionally isolated. And then he's also, and socially, like I said, he's in a kind of Western cowboy culture. And then I think politically he's isolated. This is a guy who's going to go knock on your door. And it's this long-haired bureaucrat who is in the same country where his president is saying that, you know, government's the problem. So something dramatically shifting socially and politically right around when the book is set, and that's affecting him as well. And in my research, you know, when I spoke with social workers and professionals in academia about it, many of them that were around during that time said that it was kind of a frightening time, that there was the sense that they were going to throw open the asylums, and you know, they kind of did.
Right, they were deinstitutionalizing.
Yeah, people. Yeah. They deregulated a lot of things and defunded a lot of things and block grants and all of that. You know, anyway, that's, you know, getting into the nitty gritty of it. But yeah, those things had an effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the way you sort of adumbrate the context, what was going on in society, the time of this.
Mm-hmm.
That you were sort of, without beating the drum too hard, you were saying there were all these other things going on. There was change going on. And I'm thinking this is like when you talk about when Pete tells Cecil about, you haven't been to treatment, I'll tell you what it's like. You're talking about a warehouse situation where the kid it's bedlam.
I mean,
it's like preparation for
prison,
greater prisons.
Yeah. So I mean, that's why this is more complicated than we would like to think, and why characters like Pearl have a point to an extent. Pearl is very paranoid of the government and doesn't believe in institutions, and you know, I don't know how much Pete does either, although he works in one.
Right, but it's on his own heart that kind of sort of propels him, seems to me.
Yeah.
He's not a product of the institution. He's sort of in spite of the institution.
Right. You know, I mean, we're all products of something. I mean, that's the other thing, too, is that it's a bit of a, you know, you're setting people up to fail, you know, when you start to talk about the system as breaking individuals constantly, because they don't. People get through them. And my personal feeling is just that, it's just a curious thing that we spend a lot of time valorizing our heroes who are firemen and women, who are policemen and women, who are soldiers. We never talk about our social workers, the people who go to that house, knock on that door, don't have a they might have a little badge, but they don't have a badge and they don't have a shield and a gun. And they go into a place where there's someone who's being neglected or traumatized. That person happens to be very little, quite innocent, and walk out of that house with that kid and find some place for them to get better. I can't think of a more soul crushingly hard job.
Yeah.
I know rushing into a burning building is, and it takes an incredible amount of skill and guts and all of that.
Right. Well, teachers.
And the
education system,
right,
just right, totally dissing them.
I think it's just out of whack, and we need to think about why we choose certain professions to valorize and other ones to just, you know, if not disparage, just ignore, you know.
But I, what I liked especially...
I'm sorry, I'm beating my drum a little bit, but, you know.
You're talking about not, you know, valorizing versus... The thing that struck me about your book was that not only do you sort of see these, like in Montana, where you have these different conflicting, seemingly, votes during mm-hmm. the 1980 election that seem to contradict each other, and then you have this individual like Pete or the others who sort of contradict your expectations, and even within the book, they contradict your expectation as you're reading through the book. You mm-hmm. expect them to do something, and you sort of turn that on its head and go off very credibly, convincingly, that they would not do that, they would do something else.
Right. I'm glad that you feel that way. I wanted very much for the book to convey, above all, the idea that we're all deserving of compassion and understanding. And I think that we tend to talk about, look at, and judge each other in ways we would not judge ourselves. We are very forgiving of our own faults, but not of others. We're very, you know, and I wanted you to feel empathy for everyone in the book, no matter how badly they behave or what poor choices they make, and to begin to understand and perhaps be a little bit easier on yourself. I don't know. Maybe we're hard on each other because we're hard on ourselves. This is a country, you know, that really like has a...
judgmental.
Well, and I think too, it's you know, we believe in improvement. We believe that, you know, you should take care of yourself. We believe in
perfectionism.
You know, and you know, so maybe if we take it a little bit easier on other people who appear to us to be failing, maybe we'll let this gas off on ourselves a little bit. You know,
right. Everybody except Pomeroy. But I'll let you read the book to find out who Pomeroy is.
And he might be the only true villain in the book.
Yeah. Right? Except for the guy from Sacramento.
Even worse guys, yeah.
Yeah. I think we'll conclude here by asking you what you're working on now and how this fits with Wieden and Kennedy, where you're currently working.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for asking. I'm working on adapting this as a possibly as a television show. I think it ends in a place where you're not certain about the ultimate outcomes of anything. There's much more story there.
Breaking Bad.
Yeah, right. But there's also, you know, it's basically a detective story. You know, social workers are people who do emotional detective work. Basically, they go in and find out what's up. The only difference is in detective shows, there's a corpse. This time it's a living child. What was your other question?
Well, just how you mesh your writing with copywriting for Wieden and Kennedy.
Oh, I don't think there's a writing job I haven't had. I wrote letters for a chancellor at a university. I personal correspondence, like, thanks for lunch, Bunny. That was great seeing you and the kids, my best, or whatever. And it was great to have a discussion about, you know, down to... corporate communications to teaching composition, you know, reading students' papers to writing poems for girls. You know, I mean, there's always a writing job that needs to be done. Yeah.
Sure. Somebody's love letters.
But though, I came late to the advertising stuff. I had a friend who I went to grad school with who I was not quite done with my novel and needed to get paid to do something, and I thought I might be all right at this, and I work at a really great shop, so mm-hmm. it's a lot of fun.
Well, you did the ad with Clint Eastwood. I'm curious about if you can just say a word or two about that. It was in the middle, during the halftime of the Super Bowl a couple of years ago.
Yeah. It was a real honor and privilege to work with all those people and put that thing together that had, at a moment when all of America is watching, you know, something at the same time, and to be a part of that is an absolutely unique experience. Right. So, yeah.
Well, something really unusual to identify with. This has been a great pleasure for me. I definitely recommend this book highly, Fourth of July Creek by Smith Henderson. And it's getting a lot of good attention. The reviewer for Washington Post, as an example, Rod Charles, said that it was the best book that he's read so far this year, which is saying a lot. So thank you very much. This has been Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You have been listening to an interview with Portland-based writer Smith Henderson, author of Fourth of July Creek. The interviewer was Jay Thiemeyer. This has been Between the Covers on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Pop Now 2014. From Friday, July 18th until Sunday, July 20th, PDX Pop Now will host bands on two stages, celebrating and supporting all ages music in the city of Portland with bands such as The Bugs, The Portland Cello Project, The Estranged, Purse Candy, Orchestra Pacific Tropical, Summer Cannibals, and many more. PDX Pop will take place at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Avenue in Portland. More information about PDX Pop Now 2014 can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And finally, this morning, we hear an interview from the series Between the Lines on the recent ruling by a Chilean court finding the U.S. complicit in the murder of two Americans during the 1973 Chile coup. Scott Harris speaks with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive.
Many Americans are unaware of their government's involvement in a host of Cold War-era coup d'états, targeting nations mostly in the developing world that were viewed as allies of the Soviet Union and a threat to U.S. national security. One of those nations was Chile, where a moderate socialist, Salvador Allende, was democratically elected as president in 1970. Then U.S. President Richard Nixon and his Secretary of State Henry Kissinger supported a plan to overthrow Allende's government by backing a military coup launched by Chilean General Augusto Pinochet. After Pinochet seized power on September 11, 1973, Allende was killed or committed suicide, and thousands of suspected leftists were rounded up, with many being tortured or killed. Among those who were murdered by the U.S.-backed regime were two U.S. citizens, 31-year-old filmmaker Charles Horman and 24-year-old student Frank Teruggi, who were both living in Chile during the coup. Horman's wife and parents' search for answers about his disappearance was the subject of the Academy Award-winning 1982 movie Missing, starring Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek. Now, 40 years after their deaths, a Chilean court issued a ruling on June 30th that found the U.S. government was complicit in the murders of Horman and Teruggi by providing Chile's military information that led to the orders for their execution. Your reporter spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive and author of the book The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Here he assesses the significance of the Chilean court decision, both for Chile and current U.S. foreign policy.
It's always been a question why these two Americans, out of the hundreds of Americans who were in Chile at the time, were not only detained, but then executed at the National Stadium. They are two of more than 1,200 casualties, killings, executed in the weeks and months following the U.S.-supported coup on 9/11/1973. And for years, their families have been pushing to find out what happened to them. 40 years have gone by since they were killed, and 14 years has gone by since the families started court proceedings in Chile in a hope that investigative detectives and the judge would find out what actually happened to them. And that process has taken a significant step forward in recent days.
Peter, what's the evidence that was presented in court that pushed the judges to rule that the United States was responsible for these two murders of these U.S. citizens?
the evidence that the judge has presented is not actually evidence so far. He has made a ruling in which he has made a number of assertions. More than two years ago, he indicted a U.S. military official named Captain Ray Davis, who had been head of the U.S. military group in Chile at the time, and who'd crossed paths with Charles Horman. Davis had an office on the floor of the Chilean military intelligence building, and the judge's argument was that he headed a team of U.S. intelligence officers who had gathered information on Americans in Chile and had passed that information to the Chileans. And in passing derogatory, hostile information about Frank Teruggi and about Charles Horman to the Chilean military, U.S. officials had been complicit in targeting those two, not only for arrest, but eventually for execution. The argument is not that we executed them or that we told the Chileans to execute them. It's simply that U.S. officials put Charles Horman and Frank Teruggi on the radar screen of the Chilean military by passing information about their leftist activities to the Chileans. What the evidence is that U.S. officials did pass that information is hard to know. We haven't seen the judge's investigative files. In his various rulings and indictments, he has made these assertions without actually citing the actual documentation that he has. We do know that in the case of Frank Teruggi, he came across a radar screen of the CIA and the FBI, not in Chile originally, but in Germany, where there was a lot of anti-war, anti-Vietnam War individuals pushing U.S. soldiers to defect from their bases in Munich and Bonn. And because Frank Teruggi was a member of an anti-war solidarity group in Chicago, a letter that he had sent to an individual who was being surveilled in Germany was intercepted. And the FBI wrote a report on him in 1972 that actually had the address of his house in Chile in the report. And the FBI opened a file for him that labeled him subversive. And part of the judge's hypothesis, I think, is that these documents made their way to Chile and were given to the Chileans. We don't know that that actually happened, but I believe that is his hypothesis.
How does the U.S. complicity in murders of U.S. citizens 40 years ago in Chile relate to the current U.S. program that uses unmanned aerial weaponized drones to target U.S. citizens alleged to be involved in terrorist activity today? As an example, one of those U.S. citizens killed was Anwar al-Awlaki and his son, both assassinated by drones in Yemen. What are the lessons we can learn?
Well, you know, your listeners will be interested to know that the very first major debate over targeted assassination came, you know, as kind of in the aftermath of the revelations over the U.S. role in Chile in the mid-1970s, and a special Senate committee did a special report called Alleged Assassination Plots Against Foreign Leaders. And there was a whole chapter on this assassination sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency, paid for by the U.S. taxpayer, of a Chilean general, the chairman of the Chilean Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, it would be the equivalent of assassinating the top general who runs our Joint Chiefs of Staff right here in Washington. And that was what was done in Chile. Why? Because he stood up for the Constitution and said Salvador Allende was duly democratically elected, and I'm not going to order my troops to overthrow him or block his inauguration or ratification as president. And for that, he was targeted by the CIA and eventually murdered. One of the things that came out of the scandal over Chile and the assassination of Rene Schneider and others was kind of a mandate by the U.S. Senate that presidents step up and take responsibility for covert operations. And so now all covert operations, the president has to send a report to Congress saying that he has authorized them. And in the case of these drone attacks, we know that, in fact, they are made off of a list that the president of the United States actually approves. So President Obama is responsible in the end. The buck stops with him on these murders, not only of U.S. citizens by drones, but all the casualties that have been committed by drones, which number in the hundreds and thousands at this point. And whether he will ever be held accountable because his signature is on the authorization is up to the human rights movement and the sense of justice and indignation the American public feels. We're operating in a post-9/11 world, and eventually we will get back to the moral compass of our country. We'll look again at Chile and we'll see what country we want to be. And programs like the drone assassination program will be debated in a different way.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive and author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Learn more about the Chilean court ruling and U.S. support for the 1973 coup in Chile by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Shocks of Sheba has also been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery. Committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs, Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.
Peace, love, and greetings. Yeah, 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 yeah. Here comes a musical thing called Bring Your Queen or Lock Your Machine. Oh, yeah.
Pull up, pull up, pull up, pull up, set that lift from the top. Pull up, pull up, pull up, pull up, set that lift from the top.
Here comes a musical thing called Bring Your Queen or Lock Your Machine. Oh, yeah. But a wee boo, but a wee boo, but a wee boo, yeah, yeah. Oh, hey. I love the vibes, I know the rhythm, my job. But me now coming at the dance hall strap.
Music is all we got. Now we must defend it.
Dance hall, no need no war.
Man and woman for part.
Everyone is a star.
Like King Alif and Mama Miga.
Dance hall, the people's church.
Yes, it's where everyone's gathering.
Need no bothering.
I just love. So everyone, everyone
must come together.
Everyone, everyone
join in the pleasure.
Everyone, everyone
music forever.
The sweetest relief, God's all sweet.
God's all sweet.
God's all sweet.
God's all sweet. I love the vines and how the girls them dress, yes.
And everyone that come express themselves.
Them dress.
Well, I said pull up, pull up, pull up, pull up, set a lift from the top. The music tone is sweet, but check the message that I got. In come the musical thing, and bring your queen, and lock your Glock. And the truth and the nuts who are so chat.
Dancehall, no need no war.
Man and woman for part.
Everyone is a star.
Like King Alf and Mama Mika.
Dancehall, the people's church.
Yes, it's where everyone's gathering.
Need no bothering. I just love.